Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. 2015 was one for the books in so many ways. On this week's show, as we prepare for the year to come, we're taking a look back at the triumphs and tragedies of the year past. 2015 was a big one for Louisiana Eats. It was our fifth year on the air, and our listeners and friends include the NPR affiliates WWNO, WRKF, KRVS, and Red River Radio. We moved our studio into the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and the Press Club of New Orleans named us Best Radio Show of the Year for our work in 2014. But those highs were matched with the lows that come with loss. Mildred Covert, who taught the world how to cook Creole and Cajun while keeping kosher, left us in the spring. And in the fall, we lost the man who taught the world to love the food of South Louisiana, Chef Paul Prudhomme. We'll hear from Sandy Hansen, who was there at Cape Paul's from the day they opened the doors in 1979, and from her brother-in-law, Chef Frank Brightston, who credits his culinary successes to his friend and mentor, the man he simply calls Chef. But then, we'll celebrate Antoine's amazing 175 years, a landmark occasion they marked in 2015. It's time for Auld Lang Syne on this week's Louisiana Eats. Chef Paul Prudhomme changed the American food world forever with his creative, exuberant love for Creole and Cajun food. He was the first American chef to take the reins at Commander's Palace, where the world first had a taste of his culinary genius. He pioneered the now commonplace farm-to-table movement as he championed Louisiana's farmers and fishermen. Here's what Ella Brennan told me about him.
He's one of the most natural cooks you'll ever find. It's in him. I talk about magic in their hands.
Mm-hmm.
They either have it or they don't. And what do I mean by that? It's what they're going to put in. I mean, it's the seasoning. It's the selection of the dish to begin with, the raw material, where they're going to serve. And if they have this magic in their hands, they can take this wonderful dish and wow.
But Paul had magic in his heart as well. No one knows that better than Chef Frank Brightston and his sister-in-law, Sandy Hansen. Here they are to tell us tales previously untold about the great chef, Paul Prudhomme.
You know, Paul and Kay are responsible for me being who I am and where I am, and for Sandy and her sisters, us all being together. Sandy is one of the three sisters that led the charge, you know. She came to New Orleans first, and then Rhonda followed later, and then Marna came to visit one Christmas, and we fell in love. So here we are, 30 years later.
What a wonderful, wonderful story, and it all intersects with Paul and Kay. Sandy, you and I were sitting together, actually, at Paul's funeral, and that's when you began to tell me the most amazing tale. Tell me about how you met Kay, Paul's wife, and how the two of you came to work together.
Well, it's a long, strange story, but we had both arrived in town near the same time, and we were actually working at the Dungeon, which was a key club in the French Quarter, one of those places that opened at midnight. So that was the late 60s. That was like 1967. I had just come from North Dakota not too long ago, and she was Miss Miles City, Montana. So we realized we had that in common, and so we became good friends over that, and then we became roommates and worked a bunch of different places in the quarter. She worked at La Strada on the corner of Bourbon, and I worked at Joanne Clevenger's little bar next door called Andy's, which was a little French Quarter bohemian bar. And so through the late 60s, we were buddies and ran the quarter, and that was our beginning.
That's there. A very special time. What a special time in the New Orleans French Quarter that was. So when did you meet Paul?
Well, it was very fortuitous how Paul and I met. I was 24 years old, and I was without a job, an apartment, and a car. And so I moved back in with my folks. And after a couple of weeks of that, I realized I had to do something. So I picked up the classified ads, and there was an ad for Commander's Palace. This was 78. And it said, now hiring Creole cooks or people willing to learn Creole cuisine. That struck a chord with me. At that point in my life, I decided I wanted to, you know, work in kitchens for a profession. And I wanted to learn. So I got Mom to drive me down for an interview at Commander's, and I had there was a lot of people applying. And I had a 1 hour interview with Paul. And at the end of it, he said, okay, good. Come back next week and we'll talk again. So I came back the second week. There was a few less applicants. And they were, in hindsight, culling applicants. And we talked for another hour. And he said, okay, great, Frank. Come back next week and we'll talk again. So I came back a third time and we talked for another hour. And he said, we're going to give you a chance. But you have a choice. We'll hire you as a broiler cook here at Commander's and pay you a good wage and expect a lot out of you. Or you can start as an apprentice in the pantry making salads and making very little money, but you can expect a lot out of me. So that's what I chose. Although I had been in food service through my college years, that was really the beginning of my culinary career. And I worked 6 months at Commander's, every station in the house. So it was really my culinary education. And after 6 months, he asked me if I wanted to go to K. Paul's, which I'd never heard of. They had been open for lunch for a few months. They wanted to open for dinner, as it turns out. So I just said, yes, chef, you know, whatever you want me to do. So that's when I went down to Charter Street and met Sandy.
Well, one of the astounding things that I learned from you, Sandy, that fateful day in the cathedral, was that you were one of two people, it was basically you and Kay, who were there the day Kay Paul's opened up. Tell us about the opening of that restaurant and that day and what happened.
Well, actually, to go back to a few days before that, I was working at a little place on Decatur Street called Parker's. It's where the French Market is now, and they had a little piano player there, and, you know, you'd get drinks. I was working there, and all of a sudden, I saw somebody knocking on the window inside, and I looked, and it was Kay Prudhomme. And I went out, and she said, I got to tell you something. She said, we found this little spot. It's on Charter Street. And she said, we want to open up a little joint. Paul's going to get us a few specials together. You can work the floor. I'll work the bar. We'll, you know, take a lot of time off. We'll work, and then we'll take a lot of time off. And she said, can you do it? And, of course, I was already working. I said, well, I'll come this, this is going to be the next week they were going to open. And I said, well, I'll come and help you open up and see what happens, you know. So it was July 3rd, 1979. And it was Kay's mom, Kay's dad, and me, and Kay. And we, you know, we were in the front all scurrying around and wiping the tables and took those cheap little napkins, you know, the napkin thing, and put them on each place with a fork on each one, and opened up the doors. And Kay's dad was tending bar, and her mom was kind of, you know, helping bus tables, and Kay was behind the bar, and it was me. So it was the four of us. So the first day we did, you know, a few people, and then the second day, a lot of those same people came back and brought, you know, other people. Yeah, we just opened the doors and let it rip.
So at what point do you show up there?
I believe they had been open about 8 months and had developed a strong, you know, local business lunch sort of crowd, just Monday through Friday for lunch, and now they wanted to open for dinner. So we did that. I would come in about 10:30, and I was just learning how to cook, mind you. I'd come in about 10:30, and Chef Paul and I would go over the lunch menu, and then he would leave to go to Commander's, his real job, and I would do lunch service with Miss Thelma, and her daughter Cheryl was our dishwasher. And then after lunch, I'd clean up the stove, break down the line, and Chef would call me. We had a little wall phone by the stove where I learned a lot of recipes over the phone. And he would call me in the afternoon and would make the dinner menu literally at 2 in the afternoon, see what was left from lunch and what else we wanted to add, what was fresh that day. And I did dinner service by myself with a dishwasher for a while. And as it got busier, he brought in helpers for me, namely Jeffrey Rode, George Rode's younger brother. He'd come help me after school. He was in high school. Then his sister Glynis started to come in after school. And after about 3 months, his contract was up with the Brennans, and he came over to Cape Paul's full time, and then things really took off. I mean, we grew from 30 or 40 covers a night to 80, 90, 100, 120.
So the line starts forming out on right. Charter Street. What did that little kitchen look like? Because it was kind of a little postage stamp, wasn't it?
It was a dump. You know, the business there when Kay and Paul took it over was the Austin Inn, which was just like a bar and grill and maybe some other activities.
Okay.
And so the kitchen was tiny. There was a 6-burner stove, a steam table, and a fryer. You could hardly turn around. It had a very ancient window AC unit that went out 11 times in one lunch period, I remember distinctly. So we were just improvising, you know. We had a mismatched collection of old pots and pans, and the china was just mixed-match stuff. There was nothing new in the place. And that was really the magic of what happened on Charter Street. Everything was on the fly. The menu making, that was our modus operandi for years. We'd make the dinner menu after lunch. You know, at 1:30, 2 in the afternoon, and then we had a couple hours to go produce it. And that's the way we did things. And so it was a very wild, adventurous time.
We were the Wild West. I mean, it was crazy. We were, well, first of all, the first group of waitresses, first 5, 6 women that worked there, we had a tremendous bond, and we still do to this day. We were so close, and we had so much fun, and we were constantly laughing, and it carried over to the customers. I mean, we'd insult people, but with love, you know. In fact, if people came in and they felt like they didn't get, you know, kind of insulted or you know, played with a little bit, they would feel like they missed out on something. And, you know, here would be people from CNN interviewing Paul back there. He'd be aligned to get his autograph cookbook. You know, here's celebrities up at the bar. You know, here's Jerry Garcia standing in line, and it's raining outside. I mean, you know, come on. And we're just running around like crazy. It was so much fun. It was just a barrel of laughs.
And another sort of unconventional thing, other than the typical experience at a lunch counter, usually you can kind of pick who you're going to eat with, but there was none of that going on there either.
Oh, no. Everybody sat with everybody, and that would include, you know, celebrities. I can remember one time there was a table of 6, and it was this little couple. They were probably from Iowa, and another couple, and then it was Dave Burns from
Talking Heads.
So, and you know, I don't think they knew until they left the little couple from Iowa said to me, she said, you know, those nice young men, they have a band, and they invited us to their show tonight. And isn't that sweet of them? And I thought, well, wait till they get home and tell their grandkids that the Talking Heads gave them tickets to see their little band playing, you know. And that was part of the fun of it. Everybody would meet people and just this totally unconventional, you know, people from different walks of life meeting each other. It was that was really part of the fun of it.
When we come back from a short break, our conversation with Sandy and Frank continues as Frank recalls the day that Chef Paul told him it was time to go. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Now we continue our conversation with Sandy Hansen and Chef Frank Brightston as they remember their beloved friend and mentor, Chef Paul Prudhomme.
You know, I have been very blessed in my life, and I owe everything to Paul and Kay. But back then, this was before Paul started writing cookbooks. We didn't have any recipes, nothing. And this was how Creole cuisine was passed from generation to generation through the restaurants and homes of New Orleans. And I got to work with the greatest Creole chefs you've never heard of, like Raymond Sutton, Stanley Jackson, Armand Jante, who went on to have restaurants here in New Orleans, Leroy Thomas. These are the guys and gals that mentored me. And once K. Paul's got busy, we opened upstairs. So we were doing lunch and dinner upstairs and down. We had two kitchens with four shifts running, no recipes. Every day, before we opened, we all as cooks had to bring a sample of what we made that day to chef's table to get tasted. And if it wasn't right, we fixed it. But the beauty of Chef was he understood how to give you your freedom, your creative freedom. If it tasted good, it's good. Let's roll with it. My sauce piquant was totally different from the other chefs. There's many roads to get to the same place. And it's really a lesson in diversity. And that's what I'm grateful for.
So then the fateful day comes when you and Marna have married now and y'all are all down at Kay Paul's together, and Kay and Paul sit you down, Frank, and tell you it's time for you to go. Now, how'd that conversation happen?
Yeah, I mean, who would have thunk? My last year at Kay Paul's, Chef pulled me out of the kitchen and he put me in purchasing. And in hindsight, I realized now that he was prepping me to go out on my own. And literally one day, he and Kay were at Paul's little table in the rear of the dining room, and they asked me to come out and sit down. And Paul said verbatim, "We think you're ready to go out on your own." And, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I just said, okay. And they enabled us to open Brightson's. And by enabling, I mean they gave me everything I needed. They set me up with a CPA, an attorney, two of the best in the world, a real estate agent, and it took a few weeks, but I found the spot, and then they came up with $120,000 out of their pocket. They wanted Brightson's probably more than I did. And so Chef negotiated the deal for me. We signed the lease, the business deal, And he said, here's your last paycheck. Good luck. You better open quick. So I knew what that meant. So we went to work, and we got the keys to this building, and we opened 5 days later.
And Sandy, you came along too?
Well, I did. However, Kay did not want me to leave. You know, I was her right hand, you know. She said, you really, you know, she said, let your family go. Let them go up there. Let them get started. And then maybe 8 months to a year, then you can go up. Then when there's some gravy there, you can go up. She said, you know, she did everything she could. So I said, I'm going to let my family, you know, I've been in the restaurant business. I'm going to let my family open up a restaurant without me. I said, no, I've got to be part of this, you know. So yeah, we all came. We all came, and we were here, like Frank said, 5 days. We got everybody, his mom, everybody we knew out here, scraping and painting, and 5 days later, boom. It was amazing. And the neighbors here didn't dream we could do it. They, what's going on? They said, oh, we're opening a restaurant. I went, oh, okay. And people next door at Ballin's, they couldn't believe it. Yeah, I'm sure you're going to open a restaurant. And boy, were they surprised.
And what a restaurant you opened. And of course, it just follows to reason that you must have, on occasion, had some VIP customers. Did Paul and Kay dine here much?
Well, they were here opening night. I remember that. You know, opening day in a restaurant is indescribable in terms of stress and pressure. And I remember one of the dishes that I wanted to do was panaed rabbit parmesan, like we do veal parmesan. So I made the marinara sauce that day, and I didn't like it. The canned tomatoes I was using was a brand I had never used before, and I didn't like the sauce at all. So at 4 o'clock, I called Kay Pauls, and I asked Don LeBlanc to send me over a can of those tomatoes that I'm used to in a cab, which he did. He sent a can of tomatoes over in a United cab. I remade the sauce. Well, guess what Chef Paul ordered that night? Panade rabbit parmesan. So after he ate, he came back to the kitchen, and this was a part of his sense of humor I never did really warm up to.
Okay.
He came to the kitchen, he said, who made the rabbit? I said, I did. He said, it was fantastic.
I'd like to say one thing that just occurred to me that Paul said to us one time, all of us waitresses, he got us around. He said, you know, it's very seldom you get to be part of something that makes a difference. And he said, we've made a difference.
And he continued to make a difference.
Yeah.
That he carried that on until the very, very end of his life. He was always making a difference in people's lives.
That's right. You know, as remarkable as my story is and Sandy's story is, and, you know, I mean, my story is really remarkable, what he did for me. And the thing to understand about Paul is this is just one of thousands of stories. One thing Paul really respected and admired in a person was your willingness to work hard to achieve something, no matter who you were. Whether you were a tap dancer in the streets of the French Quarter, working, sweating, trying to make some extra money, or whether you were a young cook with aspirations to make a career of it, he would give you a chance. And if you applied yourself, you were rewarded. And that's the way he works. And most of the stories of Paul making a difference in people's lives we'll never know. But I want to share one with you. If I can get through it. One day I was in purchasing, and a lady walked in off the street, and she said, would you like to buy my crab meat? And I said, well, you know, we get crab meat from a couple of different wholesalers. What do you got? She pulled out a Ziploc of jumbo lump crab meat, and it was pretty. And I said, how much do you want for that? She said, $5. At the time, the market was about $9 a pound. So I said, well, let's go see Chef. He was in his test kitchen. So I brought her back to meet Chef. I left them to talk. And from then on, we started buying her crab meat twice a week. And she would bring it in, drop it off with me, and then go in the test kitchen and see Paul to get paid. And no one else saw this, but I did. He would reach into his pocket, pull out a wad of cash, and pay her. And then every time she came in, he peeled off an extra 100 or two and put that in her pocket, too. Well, the story is this lady was the wife of a crabber, and her husband had hurt his back and couldn't work. So she was buying crabs from their crabber friends, steaming them in her home kitchen, and she and the kids would sit around the kitchen table picking crab meat to survive. Paul took good care of her.
Well, Paul took good care of everybody who came into his life, and we are all the better for having had that Paul Prudhomme in the world with us as long as we did. Thank you all so much for sharing these stories with me today.
Thank you, Poppy. It was a pleasure.
Good cooking, good eating, good loving.
Yeah, you're right.
Sandy Hansen and Chef Frank Brightston, remembering the great chef, Paul Prudhomme. One of my dearest friends and mentors was kosher Creole Cajun cooking maven, Mildred Covert. Our friendship dated back to my earliest cooking school days with Lee Barnes. I was an apprentice there, and Mildred was spreading the gospel in her classes on how to keep kosher while still indulging in the authentic flavors of Creole and Cajun food. Now let's listen to Mildred's story in her own words from an interview originally aired in 2011. I want to start with a little history. How did your grandmother keep kosher from the moment she stepped off the boat?
Well, it was very interesting because that's all the Jews in those days that came. They all automatically kept kosher. And when she came down here to New Orleans, of course, this was a whole new culinary experience. Some things were comical, other things were very serious. And like what I call the Jews for centuries all over the country, they had to adapt to wherever they settled. So again, adaptation became the main thing. When she came to New Orleans, she had to adapt to the surroundings, yet she knew which foods were biblically forbidden and were not used in her kitchen. Others she adapted to.
Well, you say that when your grandmother came to the United States, she still believed that tomatoes were poisonous.
Well, she had never food with tomatoes. Now, this was another thing that amazes you when you speak about adaption. She quickly learned to use the tomato. In fact, I think for years, I don't remember any roast coming out of the oven without a tomato sauce on it. But I mean, she might have gotten a little carried away with it.
Well, tomatoes are the linchpin of Creole cooking.
Exactly, exactly. And so to this day, this is what we used to season a great thing. But the real seasonings, your oregano, your parsley, your thyme, all of those things that are so indigenous to the sauces and to the seasoning of Creole and Cajun, this is all kosher.
Of course, so, celery, bell pepper, and onions.
Exactly, and the celery and the garlic and all of that. It's just knowing what to blend with what.
Well, I know that you wrote, two of your books were entitled Kosher Creole Cooking and Kosher Cajun Cooking.
Mm-hmm.
The name jambalaya is said to come from the French word for ham, which is jambon, the African word
it's
for
African
rice.
For rice.
Yeah,
yes.
Okay. Exactly. And then the a la this and a la that. So it's ham with rice and a little bit of anything.
What's jambalaya at your house?
Well, jambalaya is more than just the rice and ham. I mean, even the Cajuns and the Creoles, they put some chicken in it, they put seafood in it, they have shrimp jambalaya, everything like that. So when I make, there's a couple of jambalayas that I make, and my husband loved the one that had a tomato sauce base, and I use the chicken, kosher chicken, take some kosher sausage. When I say sausage right now, I'm really referring to something like a hot dog or a smoked sausage, which comes kosher. And the same in regular ingredients. I mean, certainly nothing wrong with the rice and all the seasoning. And you have the same identical jambalaya. In that case, it really isn't altering the recipe at all. It's simply using a kosher chicken versus one that is not kosher.
I know that it's not kosher to eat shellfish, so crawfish and shrimp are out too.
That's out.
Right?
Lobster, so that, all of that is out.
How did you cope with that?
There were many recipes that we could substitute things for. There are some recipes that we simply did not include a certain ingredient. There were others that we didn't touch with a 10-foot pole because we didn't know enough about it. I knew nothing about lobster. I knew nothing about crawfish. I knew nothing about the oyster liquid. So any recipes that we might have wanted to convert or to adapt to the kosher kitchen, if it required, if that was one of the major ingredients, we steered away from it because it was not something that we knew would come out tasty or, you know, the main ingredient lacking, it is not good. But there were so many other things where we substituted pieces of fish. We could substitute chicken. Or as I said before, there's some things that if you eliminated it, as long as you had that spice and the real seasoning there, that one ingredient was not missed.
Can you tell us about Hanukkah at your house? What's a New Orleans Hanukkah like?
Well, I can tell you, Hanukkah is the holiday that I think is the best one to really celebrate here in New Orleans for several reasons, culinary-wise. We are so known for our fried foods. And this, when you have to fry, what do you need? Your basic ingredient is oil. And when you speak of oil, this is what Hanukkah is about. What we do on Hanukkah is our famous potato latke, which is like a crepe or a pancake, and it's dropped into the oil. But when I think of Hanukkah in New Orleans and all the things that we can do, I have made carrot fritters, apple fritters, banana fritters, corn fritters, all these great New Orleans and Southern fritter kind of thing that you boom, drop into that hot oil. It's the oil that is symbolic of Hanukkah. So there's a lot more affinity here with the Hanukkah celebration food-wise. I can't think of a better place of frying than down here.
My beloved friend, kosher Creole Cajun cook, Mildred Covert. As New Year's Eve approaches, a night of great indulgence, what's the best way to handle that day after hangover? Stay tuned, and I'll share some ideas with you when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here is this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What's the best way to handle a New Year's Eve hangover? Well, the best way is simply not to overindulge in the first place. But New Year's Eve is often a time when even the most cautious overindulge. For the day after, lots of people swear by greasy foods, and many believe the answer's a Bloody Mary to handle that hair of the dog.
I've recently heard from some old fraternity boys that they always kept some Pedialyte in their fridge for that morning after. That makes sense, but I'll confess, the worst hangover I ever experienced was cured by a Guinness float. When my dear friend Ellie called on the phone that morning after, she said, "Stay put, I'm bringing you the cure." Ellie showed up with a Guinness beer and a pint of chocolate ice cream. She put a scoop of that rich ice cream in a big glass and poured the Guinness on top. The sugar lifted my spirits, the ice cream coated my stomach, and the Guinness set the whole thing straight. I finished the ice cream float and was raring to go. I'm Poppy Tooker, wishing you a safe and hangover-free New Year's.
Everybody asks me that all the time. They say, Rick, is Antoine's is this a tourist restaurant or is this a local restaurant? One of those roles that Antoine's plays in the dynamic of New Orleans is that we're this sort of quintessential New Orleans experience. And so when you're entertaining your out-of-town guests, is this a local dinner or is this an out-of-town dinner? Half the people at the table are local, the other half the people are out of town. So it's very difficult for me to come up with any sort of an idea of who we serve more of. I honestly don't think we serve more of one group or the other. It's just what we do.
Standing in the middle of the Rex Room as lunch is being cleared, Rick Blunt brings up an interesting point about Antoine's restaurant. As guests leave, Rick shakes their hands and knows them all on a first-name basis. Perhaps that's because the French Quarter restaurant has been in his family for five generations. But over that great expanse of time, what has Antoine's become? A tourist destination? A living museum? A playground for the elite? Or a 175-year-old establishment trying to stay relevant while maintaining time-honored tradition? If you ask Rick Blunt, he'll tell you that Antoine's is all of those things. Rick gave us a personal tour of all the Mardi Gras crew rooms at Antoine's. Of course, we began in the room dedicated to the King of Carnival himself, Rex. It's decorated in the Mardi Gras colors of purple, green, and gold, with lighted shadow box cases filled with mementos and memorabilia lining the walls. Crowns, scepters, even a Rex Queen's gown shimmers from those cases. So many happy memories.
Rex is the original history. And I love the traditions of Rex. It's so wonderful, the Rexes, the kings that are on this wall,
yes,
are all so interesting because they're not only just the social elite, they're more than that. They're prominent in their own right. So it's not just birthright. It's also their life experience that makes them Rex.
They're the movers and shakers of the city.
They are. They are. And it's so wonderful that just to look at the names of the Rexes are just so interesting. They're every single old New Orleans name is represented here.
So what goes on in this room? What do the members of Rex do in this room?
Well, they have multiple traditions that are here. They do several, Rex themselves do several parties here. They do their King's Party here. They do a Queen's Party here. They do multiple other events during the year here. But it's also a room that's available to Antoine's. It's available to anyone, like all of the other dining rooms at Antoine's. There's no rhyme or reason why you would have one or the other. It's your preference as a diner. Uh-huh. So anyone can reserve any room. There's no charge. There's no preference. If it's available, I've served many couples for their anniversary, just a party of two in the Rex Room, because that's what they wanted to do. So all of these rooms are available to everyone.
Well, I'll tell you a little secret about me in this room. Do you know what I did in this room?
I hate to ask.
I got married. I got married at lunch on a Friday. I actually had my wedding in this room.
Well, that's a pretty benign story. I was getting a little concerned.
Oh, no. I'm an Ursuline girl, just like your mother, Rick. Be good. So tell me, how far back does the association go between Rex and Antoine's?
Back to 1942 was when the room was built. My grandfather, Roy Alciator, agreed to the formation of a Rex room and to put begin the pieces of it. And of course, it's evolved and grown and so on in scope of how it's worked out. But our association, I think, goes back a lot further than that. I would really say, or I have said, and I think it only makes good sense. One of the roles that Antoine's plays in the community of New Orleans is that it's kind of a place where things happen. You know, you told me that you got married at Antoine's. It wouldn't surprise me at all that the gentleman who formed Rex dined here. You know, people ask me that. Well, when did Rex anoint Antoine's? I would be willing to bet that it happened in the opposite way. I would be willing to bet that the gentlemen that formed Rex were already customers here, and they were already dining here, and they were discussing this grand idea of a Mardi Gras in New Orleans, probably here. And so why did they stay here? Well, it was just natural, because it's where they were anyway.
So where do we go next?
Let's go to Proteus.
Okay. In the Proteus room, Rick explained that he's challenged the old line crew to bring out their playful spirit while maintaining their focus on history. The Proteus room is a bit more staid and formal than some of the others, befitting Mardi Gras' second oldest parade and crew. Its most imposing feature is a giant Proteus crest, worthy of the god of the seas.
Now, of course, each one of the crews are a different entity and a different animal with different reasons for their organization, different functions in our community, different everything. So all of their traditions are different. And much, much, much about the crews are secret. So I'm not privy to lots of the reasons why they may or may not do things. I mean, these are all just unbelievable organizations that all exist as separate organizations, yet I think that they share an awful lot of membership, mm-hmm. and they share an awful lot of tradition. But Proteus does do a lot of functions here, not necessarily in their old room, because they certainly couldn't fit the organization mm-hmm. in this room. On Lundi Gras, on Proteus Monday, we host a party for the members of Proteus, and it's about 200 guests. Now, that's not their total membership. That's just the gentlemen that show up for the one party. So 200 people are not going to fit in the Proteus room, no matter what you do. If you stood them on top of each other, they wouldn't fit. But we can fit them in the large annex. And so we do a beautiful sit-down dinner, which is really a fun, you know, a fun day. Proteus Monday is one of the really, really, truly fun days at Antoine's.
Okay, where are we going next?
Well, since we're downstairs, we ought to go to Hermes.
The Hermes room was the last crew room added to Antoine's, and in 2009, it was repurposed as the restaurant's first patron bar. The crew of Hermes loved it, but Rick saw the bar as a chance for Antoine's to evolve.
Because it's so funny, you know, for years people would walk up to it and they'd bump into the trademark and they'd say, wow, we bumped into Antoine's. And then they would ask one of my waiters to take their picture.
Oh.
And then they would move on.
Oh.
Because there was no way to interact with the business. There was no way to have a memory. There was no way to meet anyone. There was no way to do anything at Antoine's without the bar. And without the Hermes bar, I had no slush fund. I had no way to ask a customer to pardon me for a few minutes or anything else. So it was important to me to do that. And then secondly, it was important for me to sort of stodgy down the image of Antoine's. Once inside Antoine's, I think people let their hair down, but not on their way in. I think the tradition of being very, very formal had run too much of its course. And we were seen as being too fancy for our own good.
Or perhaps Grandma and Grandpa's restaurant, not some place that the 20 or 30-somethings would necessarily be willing to go.
Exactly. Very, very much to the point. my daughter at a very young age, maybe 15 years old, had really candid discussions with me and said, you know, Dad, you know, my friends would never go to Antoine's, you know, on their own nickel because, you know, who wants to be boring? You know, who wants to be formal? And so it was like, wow, what a bad perception. What a and truly a wrong perception. Because if anything, Antoine's is this celebratory place that's always been incredibly fun. You know, it was never the formal of a joint. It was even throughout its entire history, it's been this sort of a European-French bistro environment, not this formal environment. But I don't know that I could have convinced
my daughter
and her friends of that, because what they saw was this formality that got in the way with having fun.
Okay, where do you want us to go now?
You want to go 12th Night?
Sure.
Are you
absolutely
on?
12th Night.
Come on, we'll go up the back stairs.
As we made our way upstairs to the 12th Night Revelers Room, it struck me that Rick's constantly juggling innovation and tradition. Antoine's is so many things to so many different people, and all of them have their own expectations that go with it. Not only is Rick expected to uphold those traditions, but he's also tasked with making the restaurant accessible for younger generations of patrons. It can be a challenge, especially when he goes over the annual Mardi Gras menus with the crews.
I don't think the Mardi Gras crews in general go out on a limb very far. You know, they're members are expecting this sort of classic Antoine's meal. And although every year we have many meetings about the menu and how we're going to serve it and all that stuff, at least up until now, we haven't gone that far out on a limb for that. So,
well, honestly, I think that people come to Antoine's and expect to have their favorite Antoine's meal.
Yeah. Sometimes I worry about them, though, a little bit, because many, many times I'll see the same group of gentlemen 5, 6, 7 times in a 3-week period. I don't know. I love a filet with Marchand de Vin sauce. You know, I mean, I think that is a classic, classic dish. It's wonderful. But after 7 of them, I might be looking to order something different. Yeah, you know what I mean? So every year I do talk to the crews and ask them to think about varying up our menus just a little bit so that it stays exciting and fun and interesting to their guests, because we want that to be an exciting experience and a fun, you know, way to do dinner. And honestly, the history of Mardi Gras is written by these crews, and it's written by the people who participate in these crews. Antoine's is just a supporting cast. We don't generate the history. We're just here to help support it.
Rick Blunt, fifth generation proprietor and CEO of Antoine's Restaurant.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old exile?
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we travel to the land of the midnight sun with legendary chef Magnus Nielsen.
The Nordic regions as such is not a cultural region. It's just a geographical construction. And you can just imagine the difference, you know, from, let's say, the southeastern parts of Finland, which borders on Russia, and then Greenland in the west.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by the Palace Cafe, home of the crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Whirline building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.